I think chestnuts are biologically programmed, if you will, to be moist. And so when there's moisture, they grab it. And so one of the conclusions we came to was that milling needs to happen in the winter. You know, after all the grade A chestnuts are sold, which are they get out the door pretty quickly, like in about 8 weeks, that's when they could start planning for milling the chestnuts, and we're not running into that moisture variability that the summer months give. Get them all done then.
This episode of Voices from the Field was produced in partnership with ATRA and the Sustainable Agriculture Research and Education Program. To learn more about SAIR's library of practical information and available grants to fund projects that advance sustainable agriculture, visit SAIR.org. In this episode, NCAT Sustainable Agriculture Specialist Tyler Jenkins dives into the world of chestnuts with Michelle Ajamian, who works with Rural Action as a network developer for Appalachian Staple Foods Collaborative. Michelle shares her experiences and insights from her work in southeastern Ohio as a project developer and advocate for small-scale farming. Michelle discusses her efforts to establish a thriving market for chestnut growers in that region. Chestnuts are a sustainable and nutritious crop with deep roots in American agriculture. Michelle explores the challenges and triumphs of cultivating them, from fostering community partnerships to promoting environmentally friendly practices. Let's listen.
Hi there, I'm Tyler Jenkins, Sustainable Ag Specialist with the National Center for Appropriate Technology. I'm here today with Michelle Ajamian of Rural Action, the network developer for Appalachian Staple Foods Collaborative. So Michelle, we want to ask you a couple of questions today about your recent grant with Sustainable Agriculture Research and Education, SAIR, and your work with the Appalachian Staple Foods Collaborative.
Yeah, well, thank you, first of all, for having me. That was a pretty exciting project, and we're hoping to continue that relationship with Route 9. So that project was with the Route 9 Cooperative, and the Route 9 Cooperative is about 6 to 8 farms in Appalachia in Ohio, and they grow chestnuts. And our project was looking at how we could look at those grade B chestnuts, which aren't the high market value, and make more value from them by adding value, by making flour, giving them to distillers, et cetera, and see what could happen.
So tell us about your main goals for the project and what did you accomplish?
Yes. So our main goals were to develop processing requirements to make a fine chestnut flour out of those grade B chestnuts. We wanted to also identify the right equipment, right milling equipment needed. And part of that was looking at moisture content in the chestnuts, because mills don't like moist objects going through them. Chestnuts especially, we saw some millers tell us about how they would get kind of caught up in the mill if they didn't have the right moisture content. So we started with the idea of trying to get them to the moisture level that you would have corn, somewhere around 13%. Yeah. What are the best practices for making it economically viable? You know, how much does it cost to mill it? And then how much can you sell it for? And we were gathering some data around, you know, just the quality of the product by sharing it with bakers and chefs, et cetera, to see what kind of feedback we got. We finally did a couple of field days and over the life of the grant, and people, farmers and other interested parties came to those field days at the farm, because the farm has a processing facility, but it doesn't have everything to do value adding.
I'm interested in your exploration into equipment. I'm sure you must have looked at a lot of new and old technologies around this.
Yeah, now that's a good question. So we went to 3 different mills to try out milling the chestnuts. And we started out at Shagbark Seed and Mill, which is I'm part owner of. And then we moved to a mill that wasn't really up and running completely, but Jay Brandt in Fairfield County here in Ohio was starting a mill. And we looked at his sifting equipment and just more or less explored the possibility of milling with him. Finally, we landed with Monroe Stutzman in Holmes County. And Monroe turned out to be the perfect fit. He isn't that far from Route 9, you know, a little over an hour away, whereas Shagbark is about 3 hours away or 2.5 hours away. And Monroe was very eager. He's very entrepreneurial. And he was eager to play around with chestnuts and see what he could do at his farm. He even went so far as to develop a pancake mix with his spelt flour and the chestnut flour. So Route 9 wound up with a new product out of that. Yeah.
Fantastic. And, you know, what is something that you thought about the project that changed during the course of the project? You know, what something you didn't expect?
Well, a technical thing we learned was that, so one of the times we were scheduled to do some milling was, I think it was in May or June. Anyway, it could have even been in the summertime. So you get the chestnuts to a certain moisture level. And we did also determine that the chestnuts actually had to be broken up into bigger chunks, you know, so that they wound up being around the size of a kernel of corn, because a whole chestnut, it's really hard to have a sense of the moisture all the way into the center of that nut. So we started out with that, but the thing we learned was that do not mill for chestnut flour in the summer. Not here. The humidity is so high in our part of the U.S. that in the summer that the chestnuts essentially absorbed moisture. I think that they're biologically, what's the word I want to use? I think chestnuts are biologically programmed, if you will, to be moist. And so when there's moisture, they grab it. And so one of the conclusions we came to was that milling needs to happen in the winter. You know, after all the grade A chestnuts are sold, which are they get out the door pretty quickly, like in about 8 weeks, that's when they could start planning for milling the chestnuts. And we're not running into that moisture variability that the summer months give. Get them all done then.
Michelle, how did you engage other farmers in the project?
Well, in addition to the farmers that are part of the cooperative, and I think there are 6 farms altogether that are members of that co-op, we had a few field days. One of those field days actually was a cooperative effort between us and the Ohio Ecological Food and Farm Association. They did a field day in August of last year. And we decided to have our field day on the same day because they were drawing in a lot of farmers to their workshop, as they usually do. So that was really helpful. We did a presentation at the OFA conference in February of 22. And that was a packed room. A lot of growers really interested in how they could start growing chestnuts. So those were the ways primarily.
You know, developing new and expanding crop markets is a really difficult thing to do. You have some other experience in this, is that correct?
Yeah, definitely. Through Shagbark Seed and Mill, we have worked with probably 12 different farms around the state of Ohio, and we market their crop to our customers.
When you're developing a new product, do you do any kind of market research or feasibility study before starting?
We didn't do market research and feasibility on the chestnuts. I mean, just a very small amount, because that would have taken a lot of time before we really hit the ground running. But at Shagbark, It's kind of an organic process, but we work with distributors and we find out what their restaurant customers are interested in. We do demos in stores and we get feedback directly from customers. We found early on in our business, we did 7 farmers markets back in 2012 in the Columbus area primarily. And that gave us a tremendous amount of one-on-one interaction with customers, many of whom were restaurant chefs. So we didn't expect this, but those restaurant chefs came to our booth and started ordering 25-pound bags from us and then told their distributors that they wanted their distributor to carry our products. So that just blew up our access to food service. Yeah, tasting is the way that we really try to, bring people in, because once you get something good in your mouth, then you're ready to think about how can I get this, what store has it, or what restaurant serves it, what distributor carries it.
Don't have time to stay up to date on the freshest sustainable agriculture news, events, and funding opportunities? You can trust NCAT to keep you connected with our weekly Harvest e-newsletter. Subscribe today at ncat.org and get your weekly harvest delivered each Wednesday.
Yeah, that's a great point. You know, I think that's fantastic to get such wonderful feedback. How do you go about gauging demand? Let's say you're trying to decide between chestnuts or some other nut crop.
That's a really good question. Well, we knew, and I think we wrote about this in the initial proposal, that the domestic supply of chestnuts is only supplying about 3% of the market in the United States, maybe a little bit more than that. And most of the chestnuts people are eating in the US are coming from out of country. So that tells you right away, if we could do it here, that's better for everybody. It's better for the climate because chestnuts are perennial and you're not shipping them as far. It's better for the farmers because it gives them some diversity on their property. We've worked with the Savannah Institute, and they're really keen on helping row crop, field crop farmers see how they could interplant chestnuts into their cornfields and then keep harvesting corn. But in 10 years, they've got chestnuts and they're going to have a market ready to purchase them. There are a lot of benefits to chestnuts on U.S. farms. Yeah, one more thing, particularly in Appalachia, because it turns out that Appalachia has acidic soil, which isn't great for everything, but chestnuts love acidic soil. So it really creates opportunities for farmers throughout the many states that are part of Appalachia.
I mean, it makes so much sense. You know, if you have 97% of that market that's available for domestic production. So what are the challenges then?
I think the challenge is waiting. So, well, there's more than that. But I think that if we were to engage, and this wasn't part of the work we were doing, but it certainly could be an important piece of it. If we were going to engage field crop farmers to try chestnuts, number one, people who are farming field crops or whatever they're farming have a certain way that they've done it, and it's hard to change. And particularly among field crop farmers, many of them, I would say the majority of them, are on a farm that they've been doing that on for generations. So there's a habit and a system in place. Why rock the boat? So that's a challenge, you know. And part of that challenge is you have to wait. You have to change how you run your combine and your equipment through those fields, because you're going to have chestnuts planted, say, 30 or 60 feet apart, depending on how you want to interplant between them. There's a lot of adjustment there. So that would be a challenge. And then the waiting for the crop to actually start producing, you're taking care of it and you're watering it. If you're in a drought season, especially when they're young, they're going to have to get water. You're protecting it from pests and so forth, but you're not seeing any income from it for a while. So I think that that's a challenge. But it turns out that, and I haven't looked at Savannah Institute's data in a while, but it seems like a lot of farmers are giving it a try. And also farmers who graze, I think those farmers would be a good audience for this, because their animals could still be grazing, but they've got chestnuts, and those chestnuts will come on later. And if they're doing pigs back, if they're raising pork, then, you know, finishing off your pigs on chestnuts makes for a high quality meat, and get a better price for that as well.
You know, when you're thinking about a new crop or a value added product for a crop, is there a creative process involved in that, or is it strictly a numbers analysis?
Well, you're talking to me about that, and I have to say that I tend to start with an idea and not start with doing a numbers analysis. In fact, I might not get to the numbers analysis if somebody didn't, you know, kick me in the heel and say, you know, we should run some numbers on this. So it's a very creative process to think about what could bring more economic value to farms, and how can we combine that interest for economic value with the environmental needs of the soil and the climate, you know, kind of climate strategies about how we do what we do. How do you do all that while saying this is a product that we'd like people to eat, you know? And I think it was Bill Davison wrote an article for our newsletter, and he's at Savannah Institute, and it was called Chestnuts, the New Corn. And just imagine, like, you know, they're imagining chestnuts replacing corn in a lot of ways, even in polymers. You know, corn is used for all kinds of industrial applications. So, yeah, just being creative and thinking about how the chestnut or the acorn or the walnut can be used, and not only eaten, but how. What are the industrial applications that could give farmers an incentive to grow those, keep those native walnut trees in their fields, you know, and encourage them?
That's a really inspiring point there. Let me ask you a counterpoint, Michelle. What are the risks for chestnuts? Do you have an experience with a new crop that didn't perform as you expected?
Well, I don't grow chestnuts myself, but I do know people who are planting a lot of the chestnuts in our region, including Route 9. I think that, boy, I wish you could talk to Amy Miller, because she's not only a farmer, but she's also a scientist, and she's looked at the different pests. You know, how do you control weevils? How do you control deer from getting in there and eating them? Yeah, I'm not sure that I have an answer that is based in my knowledge, but more in what I've heard other people say. I think a big challenge is when they're young, they need to be protected. And ideally, the farmer needs to be prepared to water them if there's a dry, like if you planted them in the fall and the following year, it's really dry. Having a water source so you can water those young plants for the first couple of years helps them really get established. But that's the truth. That's like if you're planting apple trees too, right? So any tree that you're planting for production, you just got to make sure you do all the things to make sure they make it.
How important, Michelle, is farmer-to-farmer collaboration when you're thinking about developing a new product or crop like this?
Well, for chestnuts, I think the co-op model is fantastic, because each individual farm could not afford to have a processing, shipping, et cetera, sorting facility. And so Route 9 has that at one of the farms, where they can dip the chestnuts into a hot bath at a certain temperature for 15 minutes. That gets rid of any weevil larva that might still be hiding out, you know? And then they run it through a sorter, and yeah, they have storage. They have a great big walk-in to store the chestnuts because they do require refrigeration. I mean, I think it's a fantastic example of how farmers collaborating and cooperating with one another can lift all boats.
Tell us where the Route 9 cooperative is today. You know, where can we get the products? You know, have they stabilized sort of their operations and their systems, at least from the startup phase?
Yes. So they've been in operation for, I don't know when they formed a cooperative. So the original farm started about 40 years ago, and maybe the cooperative started in the 70s or 80s. I'm not sure about that date. I should look that up and know that answer. So they have very mature orchards, and they also have some new, you know, newer orchards coming on with farmers that their trees are just coming into maturity. And their harvest is somewhere around 100,000 pounds of chestnuts a year. So between September and October, that's harvest time. It's full on, get the nuts in, get them sorted, get them processed, put them into refrigeration, and start filling orders. They also do a U-pick. People come all month in October and gather their own chestnuts and bring them back to their restaurants or their homes. They're pretty close to Canton and a little farther away from Youngstown, Ohio. So there are a number of places that come back every year, and many Korean and other Asian restaurants and families that they make that an outing every year, fill up their vans with chestnuts and do their special soups and whatnot.
And can you tell me, Michelle, how do you stay up to date with market trends in the chestnut market? How does Route 9, with their 100,000 pounds of chestnuts, plan for each year's harvest?
Well, you know, I don't know if I mentioned this, but this is a phenomenal fact. Let's say in a given year, 80,000 pounds or more are the grade A chestnuts. Those chestnuts are out the door in 4 to 6 weeks, maybe 8 weeks at the most. The demand is so great for fresh chestnuts that they don't have to do much. They already have their market, and they could sell more if they had more. So that's why more participants in the cooperative, with trees maturing in the next 5 to 10 years, is really important because the market is there.
And what's the average maturation time for the tree, the chestnut tree?
Yeah, so 10 years is when Amy says you'll see a pretty good harvest off a tree, and then 15 is optimal, and then past 15, they just keep producing.
Fantastic. Michelle, is there anything else you want to tell us about working with SARE or working with Route 9 Cooperative today?
Well, the only thing I'd like to say is that we did have sort of a forward thinking, like what's next for Route 9, and we're hoping to continue to work with them and with SARE to better penetrate the markets for those grade B chestnuts. We did have a few breweries make a chestnut beer from them. One distillery tried to make a liqueur with that, but I don't think that quite worked out for them. We're fascinated by the idea of a chestnut ice cream. And we're looking at, like, one of the things we've been dreaming about is how would a coffee roaster work to roast those chestnuts and get them to different roasting levels for different flavor profiles. So if we continue to work with SARE, we'll be able to do that kind of research over the next couple of years.
That's fantastic. Michelle, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
That's it for this episode. Thanks for listening. Additional information about this episode and related resources can be found at atra.incat.org. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe to Voices from the Field wherever you get your podcasts. I'm your host, Rich Myers. ATRA, Voices from the Field, is produced by the National Center for Appropriate Technology, headquartered in Butte, Montana. It's supported by the USDA Rural Business Cooperative Service as part of NCAT's ATRA Sustainable Agriculture Program. Any opinions, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in this recording are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of the USDA or NCAT. We'll catch you again next week, and until then, keep on farming.